This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 251 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I've got two co-hosts with me. First, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Good evening to everybody. 251?
That's right.
Feel that old.
I do. Let me tell you, I do. I can feel every one of those episodes. But also joining us, co-hosting, of course, is David Vanderhoof. He's our official Airplane Geeks historian. Hi, David. How's it going?
Hi, Max. Yeah, it's hard to believe 250 episodes. I went back and started listening to some of the old ones, and boy, have we gotten better at some times, and we've gotten worse at others.
Wait a minute, David. Are you saying have we gotten better, or are you asking a question? Have we gotten better?
Yeah, some of those old episodes are, well, not our finest moments, but hey, we're on a journey, and we just keep getting better and better. So yeah, it was kind of strange last week because it was our 250th episode, but it was also a bits and pieces episode, so we weren't really there. But it's kind of made a little bit better by the fact that next episode after this, 252, if we do our math correctly, that'll be the fifth year anniversary of the Airplane Geeks podcast. So we'll kind of do our celebration for that one.
Yay!
Our guest this episode is John Zimmerman. He's vice president at Sporty's, probably the world's largest pilot shop. John's been with us once before, I think back in episode 222. So John, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks for having me again.
It's as if you never left.
Thank you.
So, John, have you been doing any good flying so far this season?
I have. I've done my fair share. You know, one of the best things about working at Sporty's is you get to fly lots of different things for almost any excuse at all. So I've got some Aztec time and some helicopter time and some tailwheel time and all kinds of stuff. Been a great spring so far.
Very cool. All right. Well, we're going to talk with John a lot about some very interesting things, ADS-B and some other things going on. So we'll look forward to that. But before we talk to John in detail, we've got some aviation news from the past week to talk about. After we speak with John, we've got David's history segment. Do we have a history segment this week, David?
We do, after a long hiatus, it seems like. Not last week, but the week before, I, in a desperate plea, called out to all of our listeners to pick a topic for the day. And we had two listeners, and I need to go back and double check who they were, but they chose because of the 70th anniversary of the Dam Busters to do the Avro Lancaster.
Oh, cool.
And I thought that was a pretty good idea. So following up with that, so tonight's airplane of the week will be the Avro Lancaster.
All right, cool. Can't wait for that.
Cool. I still remember that movie. That was pretty cool.
I thought you were going to tell us you still remember the Avro Lancaster.
No, when I heard David queuing up 70th anniversary, I thought he was going to poke fun at me, but even he couldn't be that cruel.
All right, then we've also got the Australia Desk report from Steve and Grant. Those guys are from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Each week we have their report. They talk about aviation from the sort of the Australia Pacific viewpoint. And we also have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. Peter talks with someone that faithful listeners will recognize. He's our favorite air traffic controller from Barcelona Tower. So we'll look forward to that, too. All right. First, though, we have some aviation news to talk about. Is everyone ready?
Oh,
yeah. Ready.
Ready.
Our first story comes from The Atlantic. It was sent to us from our good friend Jamie Dotson. And this is written by James Fallows. Jim is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's actually a former speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, but he's also an instrument-rated pilot. And this is titled Annals of the Security State, Even More Airplane Stories. In the press, we've been seeing lots of reports of interdictions of general aviation aircraft by, well, I guess police and federal agents. There's been some detentions and aircraft and baggage searches. This has kind of gotten a lot of the folks in the pilot community up in arms. Certainly AOPA has been covering this to a great degree. They had some description of pilot Gabriel Silverstein and his little two-hour search saga with the Customs and Border Protection's Air and Marine Operations Center. Does this kind of shock you guys?
Yes, it does to me. I mean, this is not happening every other flight all over America. But I think what really surprised me about this was the fact that when Jim Fallows explained this, most of the pilots who were stopped had absolutely no idea, even when it was over, exactly what it was they were being stopped about, and or for, I should say. And that's really interesting, because at least when a cop stops you on the street, he gives you some clue as to why he stopped you. But this doesn't apparently hold true when you're in a GA airplane, and it's Customs or Border Patrol or that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think, Rob, you know, the big difference here is what you alluded to. This is DHS, Department of Homeland Security, usually, TSA or Customs, and not local police in a lot of cases. And they seem to have this attitude with airplanes that you're guilty until proven innocent, where, you know, even the cop that pulls you over, he may hold most of the cards, but there's some pretty good history and tradition in terms of what your rights are and are not. And it just doesn't seem to be that way with some of these other agencies that are getting involved in general aviation.
Well, and maybe for our listeners, we should give them just a few details about one or two of these stories. I mean, I did read them, too, about the guys in the Cirrus that were stopped in, oh boy, where were they when they were stopped?
Yeah, the one who flew from Santa Monica ended up in Nashville and went stopped in Amarillo and then ended up in Nashville and did the second leg VFR.
That's right. It was on the ramp at Nashville that he got nailed, I think, right? And they came up with dogs and cops and guns. And so while he tried to figure out what was going on, I don't think he ever did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in some cases, baggage has been, opened and strewn about, inspected, as it were. And yeah, it's like you say, no one is exactly sure what the motivation is.
Well, sure. And I think the most interesting part was that they told him flat out, you can either cooperate or you can sit on the sidelines in handcuffs.
Yeah, it's an easy choice to make, huh?
Yeah. I guess I tried to imagine myself in that kind of situation, being the anti-bureaucrat that I am. I would probably have trouble keeping my mouth shut, I suppose. But
and you'd probably get in a lot of trouble.
This is a strange one.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first saw these reports coming out, my first thought was, gee, maybe there's some kind of threat. Maybe there's some kind of intelligence has indicated something about to happen or something that might happen that involved GA aircraft. And so, that's why this focus. But I thought it was interesting in the AOPA piece with Mr. Silverstein, that he said that the insignia on the uniform of the feds who stopped him, he recognized as being from this Customs and Border Protection's Air Marine and Operations Center. And I took a look at that, and we'll put a link in the show notes to the site for that. But you know, the description of it is kind of scary. It says, let's read a little bit of this. It says, the Air Marine Operations Center, AMOC, is the nation's only federal law enforcement center tasked to coordinate interdiction operations in the Western Hemisphere. It says it was established in 1988 as a state-of-the-art enforcement domain awareness center to counter the airborne drug smuggling threat. So today, the AMOC provides detection, monitoring, sorting, tracking, and coordination of law enforcement response to suspect airborne and maritime activity at, beyond, and internal to our nation's borders. That sounds like everywhere. It says it's been used to conduct unmanned aircraft systems and airspace security operations, some other things. But the interesting thing is it says staff use live radar presentations overlaid on detailed topographical maps and aviation charts. They also use extensive law enforcement databases and tracking and communications networks to detect, identify, track, and coordinate interdiction of suspect targets. And this is tied into the FAA and the U.S. Department of Defense radars. So, I mean, this is a big deal. This is not, at least it doesn't sound like this is some random, okay, let's just start stopping these folks. It sounds like there's something going on here, but I don't know what it is.
I think you hit on the big thing there. It's the tracking. You know, this example of the Cirrus going into Nashville, there was another one, a guy who flew VFR from the West Coast and ended up in, I can't remember where, Oklahoma maybe, and both of them were VFR, and basically they were assumed to be guilty of something because they were flying from the West Coast east and they weren't on an IFR flight plan. Huh. And which is obviously just absurd in and of itself, but it brings the question of how did they know where these people were and why did they start tracking them? You know, there's obviously radar coverage over much of the U.S., but just who is watching and for what purpose? And you don't need to be a real conspiracy theorist to really worry about that. You know, why were they watching some guy in a Cirrus flying from Amarillo, Texas to Nashville, Tennessee, VFR? What was so suspicious about that?
Yeah, exactly.
And why all these weeks later is it that the guy that was nailed in Nashville has no idea what he was stopped for? Mm-hmm.
Every one of these I've seen, and there's six or seven that have now been reported, the pilot did absolutely nothing wrong. They found nothing. There were no drugs. There were no weapons. There was nothing wrong at all.
So what you're saying, guys, is we should stop profiling.
Apparently the profile is a VFR flight plan.
Well, I mean, but yeah. Amarillo, Texas to suddenly go to Nashville. Personally, sounds like picking up drugs or vice versa, or flying to Nashville to pick up moonshine to take back to Texas. But they must have some sort of profiles that are set up. Now, they're probably not working right, but if someone's flying a strange flight pattern, I don't know, how many people fly from Amarillo VFR to Nashville? There's got to be something. But I agree that there needs to be an explanation on why they were stopped. But it kind of defeats the whole profiling thing then.
Yeah, and maybe we'll never know what this was all about. Maybe it'll go away as fast as it seems to have arrived. Or I don't know, maybe this is the way of the future and something that we can expect.
The new norm?
The new norm. I guess we just don't know now, and we don't have enough information. But something... It just feels like something has changed, or some person has changed who can order or direct these kinds of activities. Something has changed to cause this, and if we knew what that was, that would probably explain a lot. But
I think it's the current administration trying to kill GA and business aviation. Oh, did I say that? I'm sorry.
No, I think it's the unknown. It's what you said. You know, temporary flight restrictions, TFRs, are a pain. But we've all grown to, you know, we understand them. They're charted. You avoid them because we know what they are. It's the unexpected. It's, you know, that just for flying VFR between two airports, suddenly you can be, you know, stopped and charged with guys with guns. You know, there has to be some expectation of what is and what is not allowed.
Yeah, that clearly. And I hope we get it. I don't know if we will or not, but...
Well, and, you know, I guess what I thought was strange is that if I guess I expected at some point in the story to read that maybe the pilot had turned off his transponder, which would be somewhat suspicious, or even that he could say, oh, it failed en route, and, you know, something that may have tried to make him look as if he were avoiding detection. But, I mean, he talked to... Nashville approach on the way in, had radar identified and had flight following. Not exactly a stealth operation.
I guess Big Brother is everywhere and he's watching all of us. Well, let's push on to the next item. This comes from the Detroit Free Press. United Airlines subscriptions offer a year's worth of fees. David, you guys can and the others can jump in, but I guess this is some kind of a scheme whereby you pay a fixed fee and that covers all of your fees on United Airlines. Is that how this works?
You got to give United Airlines credit on this one. I read this afternoon and my head exploded. Bottom line is we have now reached a new level on fees because now you can pay up front for your fees even before you take up off the ground. And if you pay for the subscription and you don't use it, it's the, I guess, equivalent of the gift card industry that retail has taken upon. Retail likes gift cards because it's pure profit. And there's a stat or something like 65 to 85% of all gift cards go uncashed. Well, United is following that procedure. You can pay $349 for the year to have your baggage checked for all of your United Airlines flights.
And that's unlimited?
That's unlimited.
Oh, okay.
We're more to the point, and for someone who's 6'4" like me, you could spend $499 for extra legroom. No way, I'll suck it up, United. You're not getting extra money from me just because you refuse to give us vertically challenged people some additional legroom, and you insist on making seat pitch. And I miss Dan when I use that phrase. Unbelievably narrow. So,
Let me ask you this, David. If you flew, well, let's say 18 times a year, would you pay $499 if that was spread over, say, 18 flights?
Yeah, but it's not. It's $499 up front. If I'm flying and I want extra legroom, I'll pay the upgrade.
You want to pay as you go.
Yeah, but there's no, unless you are like my brother, who does several orbits of the Earth a year as far as frequent flying goes, I can't imagine anybody wanting to spend that much money for something they may or may not want to use. United is out of their frickin' mind.
I think it's kind of clever. I think it's it sounds like a great business model.
It's a moneymaker. Oh. I'm sure that's what it's going to be.
They looked at the Amazon Prime example. Somebody there at United got the memo about the subscription economy and said, hey, why can't we do this? And I think it's kind of crazy, but I also think it just might work. We said some of the same things about Amazon Prime when that came out. Who would ever spend, $80 up front to get quote unquote free shipping? But if you believe them, it's been tremendously successful.
That's a great analogy.
But guys, the very last line of this, United notes that its Economy Plus seating will remain free for elite members of its frequent flyer program.
Yeah.
So the people who would actually do this are going to be elite flyers anyway and are going to get it for free.
Well, I thought you were going to say the people that are going to use it are just going to be the riffraff. Those of us that go steerage.
The tall riffraff.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like John's Amazon Prime analogy. I love Amazon Prime. I think that's the best thing that's ever come along. And I'll tell you what else. I buy almost everything on Amazon now, a lot more than I ever did before. And I get my $89 worth, and Amazon gets a lot of incremental business. So if this has the same effect at United, it's kind of brilliant. But it's not something that any other airline couldn't offer. So,
but I'll bet you're out of the ordinary on that Amazon Prime thing.
I'm with them. But then again, really? I'm a bookaholic. But you could also go the route that, like I and my buddies have done. If Squadron Mail Shop is a hobby shop that does mail order, and if you have a mail order over $100, they won't charge you shipping. So what we do is we'll pool our orders. We'll wait till we get to that limit and we'll do it that way. So there's more than one way to skin a cat. And besides, this is United. They're going to find a way to screw it up.
Okay. Now, can I just jump? Oh, go ahead, John.
I have to agree with that last part because I flew United last weekend for the first time in years, and I remember why it had been years because other than all my flights being late and they lost my bags, it was just wonderful service.
Oh, no. I like United.
Well, okay, then let me throw one in. I mean, what a great intro. We came back from Bermuda last week on United, and of course, I really don't like flying United, even though it's our hometown airline here in Chicago, as they call it, because every time I fly United, something happens. It's always something. So we got out there, and I got out there in one piece, got back, and of course, we had a connect from Hamilton in Bermuda through Newark. And we got to Newark, and we sat around for 2 hours, I think, and our gate, where the connection gate was right across the corridor from where we came in. My wife says, "Wow, that never happens." I said, "It ain't going to last." So of course, that we thought that was going to get changed, but it didn't. And she said, "See, we're going to get home and you're not going to have anything to whine about." And I thought, well, okay, maybe she's right. We got on the airplane, about half of us are boarded, and then they come on and tell us that they need to deplane us because there's a mechanical issue that just came up in the pre-flight, and they need to take a look at it. Here we go. And I said to my wife, I said, "Watch this. Now they're going to tell us 15 minutes. And she said, "Well, how do you know that?" I said, "Because that's what we always used to do, is tell them 15 minutes, because 15 minutes doesn't sound like very long, at least not long enough to get most people upset. And we've said something." And sure enough, 15 minutes. So 45 minutes later, I went up to the counter and I said, "Listen, it's kind of been a while. What do you think?" Nothing, right? So, of course, I pulled out my handy-dandy phone and started tweeting. And didn't United on Twitter start responding very quickly? And I thought, wow, that's pretty impressive. And, oh, maybe 10 minutes later, they started asking me for my flight number and my they wanted to confirm I was at Newark and my confirmation number. And I thought, look at this. I know where they're going. I'm going to get something for all my trouble, right? Yeah. And so what I got about 10 minutes later was a, "We'll pass all these problems on to the folks at Newark. Thanks for thanks for telling us."
Maybe they just wanted to keep you occupied.
The airplane broke anyway, and they had to get another airplane, and we sat there for another hour and something. So,
but Rob, in a step in the right direction, at least this time they responded to you. They didn't actually,
true. Yes,
which that is a step from the last event that you had a United problem and you didn't get a response at all. So
that is true.
Yeah, so
And honestly, as I did say, the part that amazed me is they did respond very quickly on Twitter. They didn't do anything, but they did
pretty
respond.
Impressive.
So I guess that's something.
I wonder how large their staff is to respond to things like tweets and other things on social media. I mean, it can't be.
The guy that answered said he was in the men's room at the time he got the tweet. No, I just made that up.
Okay.
Since Rob was talking about inspections of aircraft, could we change the order and go to the BA incident before we go to the GA article?
Oh, sure. This is from the BBC. Heathrow emergency landing. Engine doors left unlatched. And this came in via listener Mark Bailey. And this is all over the news now. So this is about a British Airways A319. They took off from Heathrow. But turns out some of the fan cowl cover doors were not secured. And then things got really interesting. As they departed the runway, the doors came off, and the right side door actually punctured a fuel pipe and caused some other damage. Now, punctured engine fuel pipes are kind of a bad thing, as you might suspect. And as the aircraft came back into land at Heathrow to return to Heathrow, a fire developed, an external fire developed on that right engine, which they shut down. But they made it down. They declared an emergency. They used the escape slides, and there were no injuries. The airplane had been in maintenance overnight, and it looks like the doors were left unlatched.
Well, unfortunately, I think what's really scary about this is that despite the pre-flight that I'm sure someone did before the airplane took off, they missed this. But when I flew for the airlines, and even corporate years ago, we kind of had that beaten into us that you don't want to undermine the credibility of the ground mechanics by appearing to be looking over their shoulder, checking things that they already, as professionals, knew how to do. And so we were basically told to do a quick scan to make sure nothing was dripping But you know, not to get too intense about that sort of thing. So, but how somebody missed all the latches on both engines being open, because there was a photo up on, I think it was, maybe it was up on the BBC site that showed what it looks like when the latches are not fastened. And there's a very noticeable gap between the metal of the cowling and the metal of the nacelle itself. And I mean, there's a gap there, and how you could miss that on the walk around is just beyond me, pilot or mechanic.
Yeah.
Well, and Rob, you know, I'm sure you heard it many times as a student pilot. I know I did, that the first flight after maintenance is always the one to be skeptical on, right? I mean, if you're on the third leg of a five-leg day, you can be pretty confident that, you know, everything's probably in decent shape. But that airplane coming out of maintenance, it's no knock on the mechanics. Everybody's human. The statistics show over the years, the first flight post-maintenance is one that you are more likely to have something go wrong on. So if ever there's a pre-flight you want to do, that's the
way. Well, you know, I agree. I mean, the only total engine failure I ever had in an airplane was when it came out of maintenance. And for me, at least, that all makes sense. But I think what also is interesting about this story was the different versions that were floating around the media, from the fact that the engines fell off, to both engines were on fire as the airplane landed, to both engines were attached but completely shut down and they glided back. It was all over the place. And
yeah, that's
how
typical
that all happened.
Yeah. This wasn't the first fan cowl separation event on an A320 family aircraft, at least according to the Air Incidents Investigation Branch, the AAIP. And I took a look at the report. Actually, it's a special bulletin. And they say that as of July last year, 2012, there had been 32 reported fan cowl door detachment events. 80% of those occurred on during the takeoff phase of flight. If you don't latch these things, they come off pretty easily, apparently, during the takeoff. But 32 of these events. And Airbus has a recommendation that is covered in the aircraft maintenance manual, a particular task for latching and closing the doors, and has recommended that after it's done that there's an inspection, an over-inspect, a second guy looks at it to confirm. But it also says that the walk around prior to flight should specifically take a look at those doors. And as Rob mentioned, the way they're designed, if they're not latched, they stick out. And so there's that visual indicator. But it is kind of on the underside of the nacelle. So you have to get down good and low in order to really see it well. But, gee, this is something that's not new. This has been going on for quite some time.
So that makes you wonder, was it the design of the latch that makes them hard to fasten, or hard to tell when they are fastened, or are that many pilots missing this during pre-flight, or this many mechanics? Boy, that number of incidents, it just seems to be hard to believe that many people would miss the same thing over and over and over again.
That just means the next time I see Airbus on my airline ticket, I'm going to be dutifully cautious as I watch the pilot do the walk around, and he damn well better touch the engine cowls.
So you guys are ruling out United. You're ruling out Airbus. There's not going to be a lot left for you guys to fly on.
Southwest on Boeing 737s.
General aviation all the way. Who
there you go. Fly yourself. All right. Hey, let's move on to just the last item. And before we talk with John some, this is from AIN Online. Congress mulls new GA certification rules. So we have a bill in Congress to change the certification process. This is for light general aviation aircraft. It's H.R. 1848. It's called the Small Airplane Revitalization Act of 2013. I love the way these guys pick names. This is from the FAA's Part 23, Reorganization Aviation Rulemaking Committee, and they say that this would these changes would double safety and cut certification costs in half for small GA aircraft. Now, I guess this applies to aircraft weighing less. This is the 12,500 100-pound sort of threshold below that. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And this, you know, this for the listeners that don't waste their time in the nitty-gritty of Washington, this is really a reaction to that ARC that's been a really huge industry effort over the last year to basically fundamentally re-examine how we certify light airplanes. You know, right now, everything from a Cessna 172 up to a Citation CJ3, you know, an 8-seat twin-engine jet airplane really falls under the same certification category. And so a group of pretty smart people have been getting together and working on this. And I think, to me at least, this is Congress's way of saying, let's actually do something with this recommendation from this group. Let's not just take that report, say thank you very much, and stick it on a shelf to collect dust.
What's different about the process under this proposal? How can we describe the difference?
As I understand it, the main recommendation of the ARC is to not get caught up in these artificial weight categories, but that performance should dictate what the certification level is. So if you're in a 172 and you're only going 115 knots, you know, the requirements for safety and for certification should be different than that Cessna CJ3 that's going 430 knots, which makes sense. I think beyond that, there's also an attempt to take some of the learnings from the light sport rule, where they use a lot more industry standards of trying to specifically write out every last possible detail of a certification. They say, you know, let's take what industry consensus is as much as we can, because there is an anticipation on the FAA's part that this isn't just a way to certify airplanes faster or cheaper, but ideally it would be a way to get safety equipment on airplanes faster. So things like, you know, seatbelt airbags that the FAA is very interested in. It's incredibly complicated and expensive to certify that on an existing airplane. So part of the FAA's motivation here is, if we fix the system, can we get people to install new safety equipment a lot more affordably and a lot quicker?
That sounds pretty compelling.
The devil's in the details. But again, I think it's a good effort, because this you know, this Part 23 rewrite committee, I think, has taken a pretty novel look at this. This, you know, this wasn't just window dressing. They've really gutted the way we think about light airplane certification. And so this is a way, the way I see it, try to motivate us to do something with that, so that, you know, it's not just a report that we all felt good because we did it, but try to set some deadlines, set some schedules, set some measures, so that somebody takes this report and runs with it and implements some of those suggestions.
Rob, do you feel good about this?
I feel good about anything that says it may make it a little easier for people to bring airplanes to market, because the problem with the certification standards is not, it's not just that they're tough. When they're tough, that also translates into expensive. I mean, we have airplanes that are expensive enough. So I'd like to really see the first airplane that comes through this after they pass this, assuming that they get it through.
Yeah, do we know if there's any opposition to this? Any arguments against it, or we just don't know yet?
It'll all be in the implementation, I think. You know, this is one of those examples where you can write the law, but the regulatory language, the way it gets implemented, the way day-to-day it gets lived in the bureaucracy of the FAA is really the key. And, you know, that's just going to take constant low pressure, I think, on everybody's part to make sure it really happens. Again, the FAA at least claims to be interested in this. They're not getting dragged into it because of the safety angle. So hopefully, you know, we can hope they mean that, and so that they really are motivated to do this, and they don't feel like this is thrust upon them, because we know how well that works. When the FAA feels like they got to do somebody else's idea, it doesn't tend to happen.
So again, we're speaking with John Zimmerman from Sporties. John, you're a vice president with Sporties, right, as I recall?
That's correct.
They haven't, you haven't been promoted to president of the company yet or anything like that?
No, you know, I've been at Sporties 14 years, and I'm just learning the ropes, so I get to work with a great team there, and some of them have been there over 40 years, so I'm still the junior guy, I suppose.
All right. Rob, do you want to kick off a ADS-B conversation?
No.
All right.
Okay. Okay. But Rob, for those of us who are military geeks and airline geeks and see things in the show notes like ADS-B and then proceeded to have to go out to Wikipedia. I know I'm not supposed to do that. And then get thoroughly confused. Somebody want to explain to what ADS-B is?
ADS-B is simply Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. And essentially, let's just say, and John, you just jump in there anytime. It's a way for aircraft of all sizes, shapes, and colors to transmit data about their heading, their speed, their altitude, back down to the ground to make it easier for them to be kept track of. And so while people might say, well, gee, doesn't that happen now with a transponder and radar? It does, but then, of course, there isn't radar coverage everywhere. In fact, if I remember correctly, I think I saw something from ICAO up in Montreal that said maybe 12 to 15% of the world has radar coverage. Well, airplanes go everywhere. And so a way that we can keep track of each other in the sense that we won't run into each other, if we can do that, that makes things flow a whole lot smoother. And but what they've also figured out a way to do is that through the same transmission system that's part of the ADS-B, we can also get all kinds of dandy information up to the airplane so that when we were out in a bonanza the other day with an iPad that had an ADS-B antenna just sort of stuck on the dashboard, we were able to get all kinds of digital weather and other kinds of airport information. And it's all free. I mean, you basically buy the ADS-B antenna and you have a subscription to something like maybe ForeFlight or I don't know, I'm sure John has some other suggestions there too, but you can get all this cool stuff on an iPad. And it brings a source of flight information into an airplane that it never had before. But that's just the first step, but we won't go much further than that right now. And I don't know, did that kind of explain it, do you think, John?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I look at it as two parts, right? The end goal of the FAA is to have ADS-B the future of the air traffic control system, and it's a way to track airplanes and to keep them separated, a replacement for radar that is ground-based.
Right, it's the basis for next-gen. I could have
exactly,
said that.
Exactly.
Except
so
nobody knows what next-gen is.
Not even the FAA. But it's that tracking technology. But what's been interesting is the FAA developed this sort of carrot and stick routine where they want everybody to equip with ADS-B by 2020. And they realized, which you have to give them credit for, that that's not going to be necessarily that popular with pilots to go spend money just because the FAA said you had to. So what they did is the carrot part of that was to broadcast this free weather. And so pilots can get free weather over the ADS-B system, and that's supposed to make everybody want to run out and put ADS-B equipment in their panel. And it's a good idea, except you can get that free weather with a portable receiver without ever doing anything in your panel. So that's probably the one piece that the FAA underestimated. And that's where all these iPad devices are. You know, they're portable receivers that you can stick on your dash or stick on your side window, move airplane to airplane, get that free weather, and never have to worry about the whole equipping out. At least that is until 2020 when the stick part comes and the FAA says you will equip.
How much does it cost typically to put one in the panel?
That's come down a lot lately. It's still not cheap, but Garmin and some other guys are making a lot of good options now, and they're in the sort of $4,000 to $6,000 range. So, again, not cheap, but in terms of certified avionics, that's not a bad deal. And it's kind of everybody's guess that that'll come down a little bit more as we get closer to 2020.
And so this the sort of portable ADS-B capability, is, did I understand you correctly, that's not the full functionality of what you might put in your panel? This is sort of limited to the weather and things like that?
Yeah, the best way to think of the portable is that it's a receiver. So it receives the weather. It receives some traffic information, but it doesn't transmit. And the panel one, the certified product, is really the transceiver. So that's transmitting your position so that air traffic control can see your airplane and separate it from other traffic. The portable ones are really just one way. They're all in. They're just receiving. They're not telling ATC anything about your position because, you know, air traffic control wants that box to be certified mounted in the airplane. So it's in only, as they say, ADS-B in only, not ADS-B out. Mm. But for most pilots, you know, that weather is just a tremendous benefit. Everybody who's flown with XM weather, for example, loves it. And the benefit here, while it's not exactly the same as XM, it's similar performance without a monthly subscription. So as we were just talking about, everybody hates paying subscriptions. It's been really
well. David
it's
does
been
anyway.
Really well accepted.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, one thing we saw when we were talking before the show started, our flying club out in Chicago, Leading Edge, just picked up its new Stratus ADS-B portable antenna, which is about the size of maybe half the size of a CD box in dimension, except it's a little thicker, obviously. But you can slap that onto the glare shield, or you could put it between the seats on an armrest, and it acts as if it is almost as good as an outdoor ADS-B antenna. And I forgot, what does that thing cost, John? Do you remember?
There's two models of the Stratus. The new one that was just introduced at Sun and Fun this year is $899, and that does your weather. It does the traffic, although that's limited without getting in the details. That's limited. And it also even has a little AHARS in there, an attitude heading reference system. So you've got a backup attitude indicator. So, yeah, for something, I say, Rob, it's the size of a remote control maybe, and really makes your iPad do things that nobody could have imagined it could do just a few years ago.
Well, and the AHARS thing, essentially an electronic gyro, let's say. I was amazed the other day. I did not know that this was included in that. And the other instructor that was taking us through it said, and of course, then there's the AHARS. And of course, some smart aleck in our group in the back yelled, oh yeah, right, there's an AHARS in that little pack. And then, of course, they looked at me and said, yes, there is actually. And he moved the antenna off the table up and down. And I'll be darned if the pitch instruments on the glass panel that was broadcast on the iPad didn't move in relation to it. Now, I'm sure it would never be certified. But in a pinch, boy, I'd sure like to know what my attitude and my heading and my altitude was. And you can get all that with this little $895 antenna. I just thought, boy, have we come a long way.
So, John, it sounds like the iPad is a real winner all around when it comes to pilots.
It sure is. And it's deservedly so, I think. I certainly don't work for Apple, but what they've done is really designed a product that works just great for pilots. And Rob is talking about here in a flying club. You know, if you're in a flying club or you rent, you may not get to decide the avionics in the panel. You know, that's not your call. But with an iPad and a Stratus, you can always have the same equipment with you. You know, that can always be your moving map, your charts, your weather. And that's a really big deal because for a long time, pilots who weren't owners really had to sit out some of the advances in avionics because they didn't get to put those avionics in. And that's one reason, among many others, we've seen pilots really leap onto the iPad because it really does give you a consistency of portable avionics between airplanes, which is just great for renters and club members.
Interesting. And when we say the iPad, I mean, are we using it in a generic sense, or is it really the iPad? I mean, are Android devices also playing a role here?
They play a role, but it is surprising in aviation how dominant the iPad is. You know, a lot of aviation app developers are smaller and just can't afford to develop for two platforms. You know, it's not 20% more work to do both. It's really 100% more work in most cases. And so it looks like, at least at this point, aviation app developers have selected the iPad. And so there's this whole ecosystem of apps there that is really strong. And there's definitely some for Android as well, but just not as many. So the iPad, and even more and more now, the iPad Mini has really become the go-to hardware for most pilots. I mean, what's amazing is it's guys flying J3 Cubs and it's guys flying Boeings. You know, this is not a class thing. It's all classes of pilots are flying with the iPad. That's, I think, what's really made it take off.
Now, doesn't Sporty's have some kind of a consulting program associated with these kinds of tablets or something?
Yeah, one of the things that really surprised us over the last couple of years with the iPad is how many people fly in heavy iron. You know, pro pilots fly in corporate or pro pilots flying for airlines or charter companies. They are using the iPad. This is not just a hobbyist thing that, you know, weekend warriors are sort of hacking to make work. This is serious stuff. The U.S. Air Force ordered 16,000 iPads. They're going to replace all their paper charts for the most part. So when we saw more and more of these people flying some serious equipment using the iPad, one of the things that comes with that is more rules and regulations. You know, if I'm a weekend warrior, I can take an iPad and pretty much go out and fly with it and self-certify that it works for me and you're legal. If I'm flying for hire, if I'm flying as a corporate pilot or a charter pilot, it's really a whole different story. And there's a lot of certification requirements, a lot of paperwork you have to do. And for some companies, some pilots, that's really intimidating. And having been through it, understandably so. It's pretty complicated. And so what we offer is called easy approval, which is really just let us do the hand-holding, let us do the paperwork. You show up to us and say, we want to get our flight department certified with iPads, and we kind of pick up the ball and run with it from there. It's some testing. For example, you have to show that the iPad passes a rapid decompression test, checklists, all kinds of paperwork like that. You know, we've done that ahead of time. We've worked with the FAA to get that approved, so we can really simplify and streamline that for people who have the desire to go with the iPad but maybe don't have the patience or the appetite to take on that paperwork load.
Interesting. Now, I know Sporty's as the, you know, the pilot shop, but and not to make this a, you know, a pure Sporty's commercial, but Sporty's is really involved in a lot of aspects of aviation.
Oh yeah, we're really, if we, you know, we can steal your name, we're really just airplane geeks at Sporty's. We just love airplanes. We're all pilots, and so if we can find a way to make it fun and interesting in aviation, we'll do it. So we've got the catalog, obviously, that most people know. We also run a very active flight school. I got about 35 instructors and over 100 students in our flight school. We run an avionics shop, aircraft and Robinson helicopters, really a whole slew of things. If it's aviation, especially general aviation, you know, we're kind of piston airplane guys. And if it's involved in that, we want to be in it.
Well, that's fantastic. It sounds like a dream job, you know. I mean, between your job and Benet Wilson's job, I'm not sure which one I'd prefer.
I get to go to work on the airport every day, and that's never a bad thing. No matter what, that is always better than most other offices. So.
Wow.
Well, you know, John, I was wondering, you know, we were talking about, of course, the iPad and the Stratus antenna, and I know that there are a few other, I don't know if we'd call them competing products. I mean, Garmin has something that is similar to the Stratus, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, Garmin has the GDL39, which is a portable ADS-B receiver. And what we found with these ADS-B receivers, they're really a lot of them tied to an app. So the Stratus works with ForeFlight. The Garmin GDL39 works with Garmin's Pilot app and also Garmin portable GPSs. You know, the work to integrate an ADS-B receiver with an app is not plug and play. It's pretty intense. And so a lot of these devices work with specific apps. So there's a healthy market in that with Stratus and the Garmin product. There's a new one from SageTech called the Clarity. Dual Electronics, a company that's been making iPad GPSs for a few years now, has got one. So it's just incredible. You know, 16 months ago, most pilots hardly knew what ADS-B meant, me included probably. You'd heard the headlines about it, but you had no idea what it was. And now, you know, a year and a half later, there's this booming market and this really intense competition among different devices that really, at the end of the day, we have to step back and say, this is great for pilots. You know, here's a category invented almost overnight that makes flying easier, safer, and more affordable, and there's good competition in it. You don't see that too often in aviation, so I think it's important we be thankful when we do come across something like that.
Well, and when I saw the Stratus being hooked up to the iPad at our training session the other day, I believe they told me that the Stratus communicates with the iPad via Wi-Fi. Is that correct? Did I get that right, or is it Bluetooth?
It's Wi-Fi. Some of them are Wi-Fi. Some of them are Bluetooth. It doesn't really matter. One of the advantages with Wi-Fi is you can connect multiple devices. So we have some pro pilot cockpits where there's one Stratus and two or three iPads, or two iPads and two iPhones, and those can all connect to one Stratus. So about the wireless. You can put it on a glare shield or put it on a side window and kind of forget about it. You don't need another wire in the cockpit.
Yeah, good point. The only thing one of the guys told me the other day was that when he was out in the Bonanza, he put the iPad on the seat next to him while I was out playing for the morning, and I guess it sat in the sunlight and it cooked it. I mean, didn't destroy it, but it got so hot that it just shut down. So we always have to remind people that tablet computers do not like direct sunlight.
No, you got to find the place in your airplane that works and remember that. It's different in about every airplane, but I made the mistake once of breaking out on top on an IFR day, and I put my iPad up on the glare shield right in the sun, and I forgot about it. And about an hour and a half later, we descend down. We're starting the instrument approach. And so what do? I reach up for my iPad. And I should have had a clue when I grabbed it and burned my finger. Nice. But I picked it up, and I'm trying to look at the approach chart, and it won't turn on because it overheated sitting there in the sun. So it's like a lot of things in life. Most pilots make that mistake once, and then you remember never to do it again.
That's right. And with these electronic systems, you do need a backup somewhere.
Yes, definitely.
Whether it's paper or... I guess you could have all the charts stored somewhere on your iPhone or something, maybe.
A lot of people do that. An iPhone is a backup in a pinch. It'll work.
So how come we have all this, these iPads and tablets and iPhones and things being used by pilots, but when Rob is sitting in the back of that United flight grousing about something or other, he's got to turn his stuff off? Why is that? Does that make sense?
It makes no sense I think at it's all. About-
that is really an interesting theory there, Max. Putting two and two together and getting four. What a concept. Maybe the FAA should start trying it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in the FAA's defense, though, I think what they are doing is they are protecting against the unknown. It's not that there are dozens and dozens and dozens of cases a month of some sort of electronics interfering with a navigation system on an airplane. I mean, the few times I've heard of anything... it's something where an airplane was in some odd place in some odd situation and it occurred and they turned it off and suddenly the airplane springs to life. But this is not happening all over the place. They just aren't sure and they don't want to get this wrong. So it's the government. So they tend to err on the side of caution.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I understand. Well, Rob, have you ever flown a Vans RV-12?
No, I used to drive a van, but I don't think that's the same thing.
John, tell us about the Vans RV-12.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. For me, you know, growing up as just a normal airplane guy, Cessnas and everything, I don't have a home builder bone in my body. I wouldn't want to fly anything I built. I wouldn't trust it. But I was aware of the name Vans and Vans Aircraft and these guys out in Oregon. And really, it turns out, obviously, home builders know this, but a lot of non-home builders, I don't think, appreciate quite what Vans has done over the last few decades. They're really building in kit form about as many, if not more, airplanes than anybody else out there, more than Cessna, more than Cirrus. They're shipping hundreds and hundreds of kits a year. There are thousands and thousands of Vans airplanes flying out there, and they're really remarkable airplanes. They're a lot of fun to fly. They fly like a sports car. They're affordable to own. They're fun airplanes, but because they've been kit built, because they've been home built, they're kind of written off in a lot of pilots' minds. But in the last couple of years, Vans has come out with their RV-12, which is a two-seat, single-engine, light sport airplane. So it can be flown under the LSA rules. You don't have to have a medical certificate, fly it with a sport pilot license. But they've gone the next step, and instead of just having a home-built LSA, they're actually having a factory-assembled version of the RV-12. So a guy like me, who couldn't tell a wrench from a hammer, can buy one of these RV-12s assembled and fly it away. And you get access to this whole world of Vans aircraft that is really, really exciting without it having to be a home-built. So it's just it's a neat story that is just starting to get out there. And I think for a lot of pilots that don't think of themselves as Vans type people, it may be a reason to take a look again. I had not flown an RV until just a couple years ago, but they're really wonderful airplanes.
They're nice looking too. I like the lines of the RV-12.
Mm-hmm. And Dick Van Grunsven, who founded Vans and is still there, an engineer at heart and knows his stuff. Knows how to make an airplane that performs good speed on not a lot of fuel burn, really fun to fly,
Now, Sporty's has a sweepstakes that involves an RV12.
That's right. So the 2014 sweepstakes, the airplane we'll give away at our fly-in next year, is one of the first 12 of these factory-built RV12s. They're called the Signature Series. The first 12 RV12s are factory-built, and they have a really great-looking custom paint scheme, and they've got Van Signature on the side, and they've got a custom avionics package. So it's sort of a special series, and we are really thrilled that we get to give away one of those 12. It's going to be, I think, our 30th airplane we've given away over the years. And so everybody that places an order or requests a catalog between today and next May is automatically entered to win. We'll call one lucky customer next year at our flying, and they get the RV12. We have a lot of fun with our sweepstakes every year. You know, this year we gave away a Legend Cub, which was a lot of fun, but this RV12 is really something special. It is really going to make somebody's day, I think, when they win it.
Wow.
John, maybe we can tell listeners. Now, does it matter if they are inside the U.S. or can they be anywhere?
Anywhere. We've had a couple of winners from outside the U.S. We had a winner from the Netherlands, I believe, a few years ago. We had a winner from Germany about 10 years ago. So anywhere. Anywhere at all. We even had
except Australia, right? Because we don't we know those guys can't fly. They're upside down.
They fly
anyways.
Upside down. Right?
Well, you know, with the RV12, one of the cool features of it is that the wings fold. So we can just fold those wings and stick it on a boat and send it their way.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, Steve could take it on the train.
That's right.
When he was between trips, he could sit in the back and go.
It sounds like fun.
So how would people enter? Are they just dial a number or send an email, or how does that work?
Every time you order from Sporty's, you get entered. So whether it's a sectional chart or a Bose headset, you get entered to win. And we randomly pick one order from the last year at our fly-in and call that person up. So you want to answer the phone in the middle of May if Sporty's calls.
So, John, I have a question.
Okay.
So if I win the RV12 next year, would you recommend that I get flight instruction from Rob, or do you think I should go somewhere else?
No comment.
Depends on whether you want a license or not. Oh, Max, I could teach you things that would amaze you.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
I might be able to teach you how to fly, too.
Okay, that's great.
No, actually, I'd send you over to Batavia. I mean, that'd be a lot of fun. Hmm. Well, John, didn't you, speaking of that for just a minute, didn't you guys have a program, or do you still have it, about people getting their private certificate fairly quick, is sort of an intense program?
Yeah, our flight school, Sporty's Academy, does a lot of local area business, but we also have a lot of students come in from out of town or even overseas. And so we do a lot of accelerated programs. We had one guy who works at Sporty's got his license, zero to license, in 2 weeks. He was really committed. But we also do a lot of what we call finish-up courses, where a person maybe started flight training years ago and got part of the way there, and life got in the way, a flight instructor left, ran out of money, whatever it might be, and now's the right time. He wants to get back in and finish it up, and he doesn't want to do it an hour a week over 9 months. And so he'll come to Sporty's and live with us for a couple weeks and knock it out. And we've been doing an awful lot of those. They're, it's really rewarding anytime you teach somebody to fly, but it's great to get one of these people who, the flame was almost out, and we found a way to get it going again and to get them that license and send them home happy. So
that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you teach old guys to fly helicopters?
The one thing we don't do is helicopter training. We're just not that brave, Rob. I have a helicopter rating. I remember what I did to my flight instructor, and I just wouldn't want to wish that on any of our nice flight instructors at Sporty. So.
Oh, no.
I see.
All right. Very good. All right, John, tell our listeners where they can find Sporty's.
So Sporty's is really anywhere you want to be, sporty's.com on the web, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or any of your favorite places there. And would go ahead and request a catalog, and that'll get you entered for that RV12 as well. So you don't even have to pay any money for it.
Sounds great.
But, of course, the more people that enter, the less chance I have of winning.
That's true, Rob. That's true.
I'm just saying.
All right. John, thank you so much for coming back to the Airplane Geeks podcast. It's been a great conversation. Look forward to having you on again, if you will.
Thanks for having me, guys. Always enjoy it.
Yeah, you didn't learn your lesson last time, did you?
Apparently not. I'd love to come back.
Oh. No, it was great having you, and I really appreciate the chance to talk to our listeners about ADS-B and some of the cool new toys that we're seeing for pilots.
And now here's our official Airplane Geeks historian, David Vanderhoof.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, the Avro Lancaster, or Lancaster. I'm not quite sure. Born out of the two Rolls-Royce Vulture-powered Manchester, the Lancaster was a growth of the original design by Roy Chadwick. The Manchester was severely underpowered, and Chadwick replaced the two Vultures with four 1,280-horsepower Rolls-Royce Merlin 20 liquid-cooled V12s. To accommodate the less powerful engines, the wings were increased from 90 feet 1 inch with the wing area of 1,131 square feet of the Manchester to 102 feet long with 1,297 feet of wing area for the Lancaster. A side note to all those out there, the Merlin is actually named for a small falcon, Falco columbarius, not the wizard of the Arthurian lizard. I will vouch that growing up that I actually thought it was a wizard. All Rolls-Royce piston aircraft engines are named after birds. So now back to our regularly scheduled program. Only 200 Manchesters were built. On January 9, 1941, the Avro Type 683 Manchester III took to the skies. It was clearly a new aircraft and was given the designation Lancaster B1. The prototype did have the Manchester's original three tail fins. This was immediately replaced with a wider tailplane and the elliptical verticals so now familiar with the Lancaster. The Rolls-Royce Merlins drove 13-foot de Havilland three-bladed props. The Lancaster, like all good airframes, were capable of handling multiple power plants. Merlins were in such high demand given that they powered most of the Royal Air Force's fighter forces. To compensate, 300 Lancaster B-2s were created as a stopgap measure. The B-2 used either the Bristol Hercules 6 or 16 engines. The Hercules also powered the Halifax and Stirling, completing the triad of bombers, as well as the Bristol Bow Fighter. The B-2 variant was built concurrently as the B-1, but the difference was the Merlins. The B-3 used the Merlin 28, or the V-1650-1, built by the Packard Motor Company. Much like the B-17, the Lancaster was a work in progress, and as changes were made to either one of the lines, or one or the three, it would eventually be implemented on the other line. The B-4 would obtain an increased wingspan and fuselage. This would be such a modification that eventually it would be renamed the Lincoln B-1, or the successor to the Lancaster. The last major variant was the B-10. The B-10 was built by Victory Aircraft in Ontario, Canada. The 430 built used Packard engines and had U.S. style of instrumentation as well as electrical systems. You can't talk about the Lanc without talking about its weapons. For its time, the bomb bay, 33 feet long, was huge. The maximum payload was 4,500 pounds for a B-17 to go to Berlin. A Lancaster could take 14,000 pounds the same distance. The largest bomb originally used was a Cookie, a 4,000-pound high explosive. Eventually, the bomb bay was bulged, allowing for 8,000-pound and 12,000-pound Cookies. We just celebrated the 70th anniversary of Operation Chastise by 617 Squadron. 617 Squadron was equipped with B3S or Specials. The doors were removed and aerodynamic fairings were put in front and back of the bay. Barnes Wallace, a chief designer at Vickers Corporation, had come up with a novel way of attacking dams, the upkeep bomb. The bomb was designed to skip across the water, much like a stone does. The oil drum-shaped bomb was spun up to 500 RPM in the modified bomb bay. The spin was reverse of the forward flight of the aircraft. The Lancaster flew down the river at the dams on the Eder, Moan, and Roar rivers. Ahead of the dam, the bomb was spun up to speed and released. It skipped over the torpedo netting before the dam and impacted the wall. Then, because of the reverse spin, sank to used a pressure fuse to blow up the bottom of the dam, causing it to breach. The attacks on the night of June 16, 1943, were modest successes. 8 of the 19 617 Lancaster bombers were shot down for 2 dams breached and a third damaged. Today, the Dam Busters, or 617 Squadron RAF, currently fly the Tornado GR-4. Wallace also created the earthquake bombs. The first of these was the Tallboy. Tallboy, of which 854 were built, was a 12,000-pound high-explosive bomb to be used against hardened targets. Dropped from an altitude of 18,000 feet, it would penetrate the ground before detonating. Tallboys were used in Operation Crossbow. These were the attacks on V-1 and V-2 production facilities underground. When the Tallboys were used to attack the Surmer tunnels, the Tallboys did not explode until they were 60-plus feet below the surface. Also, the most famous German battleship, the Tirpitz, was also sunk by a Tallboy. The Tallboy was big, but Wallace created something even bigger. The 22,000-pound Grand Slam. A larger version of the Tallboy, which was 26 feet long with 6-inch fins. Eventually, the RAF would use 42 of these behemoth bombs. Grand Slam would be the largest conventional bomb, even bigger than the Blue 82, or BLU 82, a 15,000-pound bomb dropped by Special Forces C-130s. It was finally surpassed in 1997 by the GBU-43B, Massive Ordnance Airburst, or MOAB, otherwise known in the Air Force as the mother of all bombs. It weighs 22,600 pounds, but has never been used in combat. The Lancaster was also one of the aircraft that introduced radar and countermeasures. Most Lancaster missions were at night, so radar became important for its missions as well as survival. H2S, Monica, G, Oboe, and Tinsel were all various mission equipment, and all were important to the Lank. The Lancaster continued service until it was retired in 1963 by the Royal Canadian Air Force. 7,377 were produced in the two countries, making it the greatest bomber ever produced by Great Britain. Of that 7,377, only two still fly: the Canadian Warplane Heritage's B-10 and the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight's B-1. So that concludes tonight's mission on the Lancaster. So what else would you folks like to hear? Send your texts using the hashtag Airplane of the Week on Twitter, or visit our Facebook page. What would you like to hear? This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, maybe I'm biased because I lived in England for a number of years, but the first time I saw Lancaster back in the 60s, I just thought it was the coolest airplane I had ever seen. Even though I thought the B-17 was neat, I always loved the Lancaster more. I don't know why.
Those are some seriously gigantic bombs.
Yeah, did you say 26,000 pounds on that one?
22,600 pounds, and they dropped 47 of them.
Can you imagine the hole a 22,000-pound bomb makes?
My God. And that tall boy, you said it penetrated the ground 60 feet before detonation?
Exploding, yes.
Golly.
I mean, we talk about weapons these days that are ground-penetrating and bunker busters.
Yeah.
Wallace Barnes was the inventor of the bunker buster. In fact, this whole class of weapons was considered earthquake bombs because what they did was create man-made earthquakes. But if you haven't seen the Operation Chastise or the upkeep bomb, you have to watch that and watch them drop it and watch it skip across the water. It's a very, very impressive, ingenuitive weapon. And those three weapons, you can't talk about the Lancaster without them because they were the only ones that could deliver them. It wasn't till the United States Army Air Corps had the B-29 that we could deliver a bomb like the Grand Slam, which we did after the war. But up until that point, the Lancaster was the heavy bomber of the world.
And those Merlin engines, they produced, as I recall, a lot of Merlin engines over the years for a lot of different aircraft, didn't they? Those big 12-cylinder Merlins.
Yeah, well, you know, off the top of your head, you got P-40s, P-51s, Spitfires, Hurricanes. All of those aircraft required Merlin engines. Problem was the British couldn't keep up with production. It wasn't until, there is a story about Packard getting the Merlin engines.
Hmm.
before the war, they contracted Henry Ford to build Merlin engines.
Right.
And Henry was a bit of a pacifist. So he said, I'll build Merlins for the United States, but I'm not going to build them for Great Britain. And so the White House yanked that contract and they gave it to Packard. And Packard said, no problem. We'll produce as many as you want. Mm. So the Lancaster's always been called the four Merlins flying in formation. It is, and if you've never seen one in person fly, it's got a neat sound to it. Luckily, I've been fortunate enough to see the Canadian Warplane Heritage's Lancaster fly multiple times. It's got a different purr. It's kind of like the Mustang. When you hear a Mustang and it's Merlin engine, it's a Mustang. And the Lancaster is very similar to that. You hear it and you go, oh, yeah, that's the Lank.
Wow, very good. Thank you very much, David. All right, let's press on with the Australia Desk.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, Sunday, 2nd of June, 2013.
Well, gee, Grant, you sound a bit out of phase over there.
Out of phase? Wasn't that something Rob said last week in the Airplane Geeks?
I don't know. Well, I'm in this week. It's episode 251, I think.
Oh, maybe it was 2 weeks ago. I don't know. Are we that far out of phase?
We're always out of phase, folks. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Australia Desk for episode 251. At least we think it is. And, Grant, we're going to start this week with a bit of local news, local to us right here in Victoria. In fact, the regional city of Bendigo now, of course, you know, I am currently a property investor in Bendigo, so this interests me a lot. They've got business jets up there now. This could be a good thing.
Yes, that'll be just what you need, oh slumdog millionaire.
Yeah, I wish.
Yes, the new slumlord of Bendigo, aka Steve Vischer. Great new announcement is that MyJet, a charter specialist, operates a lot around Australia, based in Bendigo, have opened a new $1.5 million headquarters and fixed base operation, aka FBO, at Bendigo Airport. They're actually relocating from Essendon.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, of course, long-time listeners will know that we've talked about Melbourne's airport setup before, and Essendon Airport was formerly Melbourne's international airport up until the early 1970s, and now serves as a regional airport, but it's run by a private company, actually predominantly a transport and logistics company, who make it very expensive to operate there. And I wonder that if that's got something to do with this move away from Essendon Airport. There's a lot of prime real estate there, and I'm pretty sure they'd be very happy to close that down long term. So moving up there to the regional city of Bendigo, they've got a great airport up there, and it doesn't cost very much at all to operate from there.
That's right, mate. Essendon Airport, you could call it the Melbourne Executive Airport. A lot of business jets operate from there. We've also got the police air arm, the air ambulance, a few training organizations, and some regional RPT kind of operations. Not uncommon to see a Fokker 100 dropping in there lately. That's always quite spectacular to see them come in. Two major runways surrounded by residentials these days. And with that transport company owning it, there's continuously a question of what happens if we carve up this chunk of airport land and give it over to warehousing. No, that'll stop the business jets coming in. Oh, okay. But they're continuously dividing the land in the area. They've set up shopping centres, they've set up car yards, they've set up a large, as we call them over here, DFO, direct factory outlet environment, where lots of brands have their stores. So lots of encroachment on the air environment, and it's a continuous ongoing battle. Very expensive. A lot of people in the area want to shut Essendon down. So you can see that if MyJet can get away with basing their aircraft just a few hours up the road at Bendigo, fly in as required to pick people up and make use of some of the other FBOs that are there, if a large chunk of their traffic is primarily regional, then it makes sense to be out at Bendigo and closer to those people.
Yeah, now this has seen a bit of support here, this development, from the state government. The Minister for the Aviation Industry, Gordon Rich Phillips, said in a statement this week that it's a $5 million investment up there, and counts as the most significant investment in that region, and particularly that airport, for the last 40 years. So very good. And it's a great city, Bendigo. If you're ever down this part of the world, folks, I can highly recommend it. In fact, rent one of my houses there. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, well, meanwhile, I've been out and flown a little bit in a hot air balloon near Bendigo. A lot of fun in the area. Very nice regional rolling green, that kind of thing. That $5 million investment you were talking about was the upgrade to the runway at Bendigo as part of the regional aviation fund.
Fantastic, Grant. Well, speaking of investment in airports, we'll flick over quickly to the other side of the country, over in Western Australia. This article here in australianaviation.com.au says that Qantas is investing more money in Western Australia as competition mounts. So interesting, Grant. Now, is that domestic or international or both, I wonder?
Primarily domestic. They're going up against Virgin, who are sinking a lot of money into Western Australia. Virgin have upgraded to use A330-200s on the transcontinental, as we've reported a number of times over the last couple of years. They've also invested in SkyWest, which is a major fly-in, fly-out operation, as well as regional intrastate and interstate flyer in the area. And basically, Qantas are looking to combat that by increasing their offerings, ranging from a new Qantas Club, more services, a larger aircraft, and new standard of business class meals and so on. What's really interesting is that Joyce has gone out and said that he doesn't see the mining boom coming off. He sees things continuing to boom for WA, which has a number of us scratching our heads, as there's a lot of reports going out that the mining boom has actually peaked and is dipping at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see where all that goes.
You know, I think the mining industry, as you say, Grant, it's coming down from its peak, but there's still a lot of resources up around that part of the world that are going to need to be tapped, I reckon, over the next couple of decades. And, you know, even if growth drops off a bit in China, I think there'll still be a lot of fly-in, fly-out workers going in and out of that part of the world for many, many years to come. So it only makes sense that all the airlines are investing. We've been talking a lot recently about Virgin expanding their network into that region of the world. So, you know, obviously Qantas is responding to that, and yeah, it's good that they are. It's good for aviation that, you know, all these facilities are being upgraded to cope with that. And I guess once the mining boom does go away, well, you know, we're going to be left with all these wonderful facilities. It's a bit like the Olympics, Grant. You know, they come and they spend a fortune building all these fantastic sporting stadiums, and after they're gone, well, you know, we have them all to use afterwards, which is, you know, great if you like sport.
Yeah, well, apparently so. I think Sydney's still paying the price for hosting the Olympics in terms of no infrastructure development for a while. But,
well, Grant, everybody knows that my favourite aircraft is the C-130 Hercules, and I love those big transport aircraft, Grant, but I reckon in years to come, I'm going to have an equal love affair with the Airbus, the Grizzly, the A400M, and if Airbus has its way, we might see a few of those flying around in this region of the world. They've got their sights set on the Kiwi Defence Force.
That's right, mate. They're looking at putting the A400M and the C-295W, the new variant with the winglets, out to New Zealand as a combined package. The Kiwi C-130Hs have just gone through a major refurb, but they can't last forever. The P3 Orions, you know, they're getting near the end of their life, as you were seeing here in Australia. We're going to be replacing them with the P8 Poseidons. Now, the New Zealand defence budget is relatively tiny compared to Australia, let alone the US. So it's highly unlikely that the Kiwis are going to get the Poseidon and things like that. So Airbus is pitching the C-295W, which does come in a maritime version. So there's all sorts of possibilities going on here. But the biggest thing is, of course, if the Grizzly winds up flying in New Zealand, it's going to have to be called the Grizzly.
The Grizzly.
Yeah, the Grizzly, cuz.
Well, we can get away with saying that, Grant, seeing as you were born in New Zealand.
Yeah, but I've lost the accent, mate. And according to all my mates back in New Zealand, there is no way I can be a Kiwi anymore. But we'll see.
We'll see. The interesting thing, of course, is that the A400M is a considerably larger aircraft than the C-130. Now, the Royal New Zealand Air Force has five C-130Hs in its fleet. I wonder if they did decide to go with the A400M, would they buy five of them to replace those Hercs, or would they perhaps only need to buy three?
Well, that's where the A400 plus the C-295, they're sort of bracketing the C-130, because we were looking at the C-295 against the C-27 as a replacement for the tactical transport, battlefield lifter, things like that, that the Caribou used to do. And so, yeah, the A400, smaller than the C-17, bigger than the C-130. It'll be interesting to see how the two work together, whether they go for like a smaller fleet of A400s and C-295s, or whether they decide they want to get the full five fleet so that they can really lift a lot of things. There's a lot of work New Zealand does in the region out into the Pacific. You'd have to see if the A400M can work well off some of the rough strips that the C-130s go into. It could be interesting. I'll be watching this with an open eye. It'd be great to have a Grizzly down here or two.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, the Kiwi Air Force, they quite often fly down to the Antarctic bases as well. So currently they do that. I've seen pictures recently of them flying their 757s down there. So if they can get a 757 down onto some of those blue ice runways, then I'm sure they can get an A400M on there.
Oh, yeah, the Yanks get the C-17s down there, definitely. And they used to send Starlifters down. I'd see them occasionally at airports in New Zealand as they were transiting. But it's more so much the Pacific Islands that a lot of the Kiwi aircraft go to. There's a need for a good tactical lift into battlefield conditions or remote airstrips that the C-130 provides. It's got good range, good performance, and good lift, a good balance. So we'll see how the A400M stats go up against the C-130 in terms of hot and high and dirty short runway operations.
I tell you what, Grant, just as an aside, speaking of C-130s, I've been chatting backwards and forwards with David this week over an article he published on his blog about the South African Air Force C-130s. Do you know they've got B models over there? BZs, they're called, or BZs if you're American, I guess, but they're very, very old airframes.
Well, speaking of old, I wonder if we've managed to talk our way out of Rob's out of phase commentary.
Well, I think what we ought to do is concentrate on getting everybody into phase. You know, Grant, it would be much easier if everybody at the Airplane Geeks just upped stumps and moved out here to Australia and we could all record here every week in my studio. That would make life much easier for everybody.
Oh, yeah, we could set up the Back of Beyond studio and do it out in the outback.
Yeah, fantastic. You can do it out of my backyard if you like.
Crikey, mate, that'd be an interesting one. Got any crocodiles?
Oh, dear. Okay. This is just going downhill really, really quickly, so I think we'll end it off here. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And from the future, this is Grant McCarron. And don't forget, folks, because we're out of phase in the future, we can tell you what the winning numbers are.
Oh, hang on, I'll get my pen just a minute.
5, 17, 21. Hang on, what's that distortion in the space-time continuum? My God, it's...
They obviously don't get Doctor Who down there in Australia, do they, David?
Well, I just need to tell them that the only good replacement for a C-130 is a C-130. At no point does the A-400 Grizzly, whatever they want to call that large aircraft with very large propellers, will never, ever replace the C-130. When they retire the A-400s to boneyards, the crews will be flown home in 130s.
Well, I don't know, David. You got to love those giant turboprops on the A400M. Just massive, massive engines.
Give me 4 Allisons flying in formation any day.
Okay. All right. Hey, let's listen to Peter Johnson across the pond.
This week, we have a listener, supporter, and in fact, an Airplane Geek voiceover artist on Across the Pond. Welcome to the show, Jesus Calderon.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a delight to have you on the program. It's always interesting to hear someone's voice that I've heard on the program, but then to talk to them. So it's great to have you on the show. Now, you're an air traffic controller based in Barcelona. Before we talk about that, can you tell us about your aviation background?
Sure, Peter. In fact, since I was a teenager that I wanted to be a pilot. So when I reached 17, my parents let me go for the private pilot license here at Reus Airport Flying Club, which is about 10 kilometers from Tarragona, where I live.
Right.
This helped me to meet professional pilots, you know. In fact, they were my instructors, and learned about the real situation. I mean, the real deal about the professional pilot world.
Right, okay, yeah.
This was around the year 2000, and Iberia, which was the biggest Spanish airline then, was already in a process of privatization. Therefore, they were not hiring many pilots. Then came the 9/11 terrorist attacks, which created a big economical recession, and then an even worse situation for pilots seeking a job in the airlines, you know?
Yeah.
Then around the year 2000, more or less, I finished high school, and instead of jumping for the ATPL to become a professional pilot with not a lot of hope of being hired, I decided to go for a university degree with the objective of being able in the future to apply for an air traffic control job. May the possibility arise, of course.
Right, okay.
And as I thought, this also was a great job in aviation. Then while at university, in summer, I worked at Reus Airport as a handling agent for some airlines.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and although sometimes it's tough to load luggage in cargo bay at 30 plus degrees, you know, in the sun.
Yeah.
Or even worse is to manage passengers with a lot of with all kinds of problems.
Yeah, complaints and problems.
Yeah, a lot of complaints. I really enjoyed being around the airport and being paid for it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And Hedges, did you complete your private pilot's license?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I completed it, And now I've not flown that much.
Yeah.
But you know, it's something that I always have in mind.
Okay.
Now in Spain nowadays, it's not very easy to go fly as a sport.
Yeah.
Because they have raised the price of the flying hour and the fuel and all these things, and so. But it's something that I've always have in my mind that I want. In fact, I flew a lot since I went to Madrid. Before going to Madrid to do the traffic control course.
Yeah.
I flew a lot and then I stopped it because I had to go to Madrid to study for the traffic control course.
Yeah.
And then I came back here and started working and all these things. But it's something that I have all in my mind to continue with the flying.
Okay, so let's talk about your training. What training did you have to go through to become an air traffic controller in Spain?
Well, first of all, Peter, I must say that nowadays, the way to reach an ATC job in Spain has changed.
Yeah.
Because of a partial privatization of the service, you know?
Right. Yeah, we've talked about that before, yes.
Yeah, but when I started back in 2006, after completing my university degree, I had to pass a public competition with more than 5,000 competitors.
Yeah.
At least that's what they said. Yeah. And for only about 150 places, you know, for an air traffic control academy in Madrid.
Right, okay.
So once I got chosen in this competition, I was assigned to a 48 alumni class. And in May 2007, I started the air traffic control basic course in Madrid.
Right.
Then this course lasted for nearly 2 years. And at the beginning of the course, we spent some months studying theory subjects related to aviation. I mean, more or less like pilots do.
Yeah.
After that, we learned the actual job with simulators, going from airfield tower to en route area control with radar screen.
Yeah.
And finally, the TRACON approach.
Right, okay. So now you're qualified as an air traffic controller. Can you tell us a little bit about how the sky is segmented in Spain and who does what? You talked about TRACON control there.
Yeah, well, I imagine it's pretty much like everywhere. With the Spanish sky is segmented in big FIRs, which stand for Flight Information Regions. And those one are segmented in en route sectors, you know?
Yeah.
Then all this is always controlled from area control centers. In Spain, there are four of those.
Yeah.
Then around big airport, we've got the terminal areas with approach sectors managed from TRACONs.
Yeah.
These TRACONs can be inside the same building of an area control center.
Right, okay.
Can also be on their own. Or in the case of a small airport with not a lot of instrumental traffic, then they can be managed also, because they are small approach sectors, then they can be also managed from the control tower.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and finally, we have got the control tower, as everybody knows, managing traffics from operating in and near the airport.
And so what role do you undertake?
I'm actually working at Barcelona control tower.
Right, okay.
And in the Barcelona control tower, we are about 80 air traffic controllers.
Yeah.
Talking on six different frequencies.
Right, okay.
Those frequencies, are we call two local frequencies, which manage which control the runways operations.
Yeah.
In fact, in Barcelona, we use a parallel runway configuration.
Right, okay.
So we have a controller. For example, if we are using the west configuration, we have runway 25 right for arrivals, for landings, and runway 25 left for departures.
Yeah.
There's one controller controlling runway 25 right and another one controlling 25 left.
Right, okay.
Then we've got three ground control sectors.
Yeah.
And we have one clearance delivery frequency.
Okay, and do you, in the tower, do you rotate... Yeah. Doing each of those roles, or do you have a specific role?
Yes.
Right.
No,
okay.
No. We rotate. In fact, we rotate in each shift.
Yeah.
So we used to work for about 1 hour and a half, maximum 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then we have a break of 30 minutes, and after each break, We used to change position. We switched position. So I can start the afternoon shift working 1 hour and a half, or maybe 1 hour in controlling runway 25 right. Yeah. Then I worked for half an hour in clearance delivery.
Yeah.
I've got a 30-minute break. And then I start again working maybe in a ground control sector.
Right, okay. Oh, interesting, interesting. I'll have to look up liveatc.net and see if I can listen to you. Before we go, as time's pressing, we know you're a great listener to the program. Can you just give us a bit of feedback on what you think our listeners like and dislike?
Yeah, no, that's a difficult question, Peter.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I really enjoy listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast, and I like all its segments, you know.
Right, okay.
And as I said before, I live in Tarragona, which, by the way, is a small but very beautiful city with a full of Roman ruins. So if anybody wants to come. And I always listen to the podcast while commuting from Barcelona to Tarragona.
Okay.
Every day, and I really like all the segments. But if I had to say something, I could say that, as you did previously recently in the extended podcast, to discuss from time to time a little bit about space exploration and space programs.
Okay. Okay.
I think that could be a really nice idea, because personally I'm really interested on those.
Right.
But that being said, I really enjoy listening to the aviation related news of each week on the Airplane Geeks, as it's a really easy way to keep up to date with what's happening around the world. You know,
yeah, it is. They do a good job. They do a good job. Even Rob.
Yeah, even Rob. In fact, the super super interesting interviews that you guys, the Airplane Geeks, you yourself, and both guys from Down Under. I really enjoyed listening
to. Really appreciate that.
Yeah, to your interviews, they are really interesting and really nice to listen.
Oh, excellent! Well, Jesus, thank you very much for coming onto the show. Where can we find you online?
You can reach me on my Facebook page. Just looking for my name.
Yeah.
My name is Jesus Calderon.
Yeah.
It's like this, and also on Twitter with the name Hardenau. It's Hotel Alfa Romeo Delta Echo November Alfa Whiskey. And in fact, I want to say, if there is anybody listening to this show, or in special any pilots flying to Barcelona from around the world, that may be interested on visiting the tower and enjoying the sharing with me the view we've got from there, they just have to ask me.
Oh, I'm coming.
Yeah, you will be more than welcome.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
My pleasure, Peter. Anytime.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Very cool.
Yes, I still say we have the best listeners of any show around. I just love that.
Yeah, even Rob.
Even Rob. You know what I always wanted? My dream episode is one where it's just the listeners, you know, calling in or something like that, where we just talk with listeners, you know, one after the other, after the other, after the other, and just pack as many as we can into a show. I don't know.
Well, remember that idea we had a couple of months ago? We actually never followed up on it, about trying to maybe audition some listeners to see if we could get a couple of them on the show at some point to co-host, or maybe we should look into that more.
I think that's a really good idea. We could have a little,
We don't want them to be too good.
No. Not as good as us, certainly, right?
Right.
We don't want, because they may start their own podcast, for God's sake.
Gee, what a concept. Yeah. I wonder where they'd come up with that kind of an idea.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Considering how many spinoffs we have.
Yeah, it wouldn't be unexpected. But yeah, let's, okay, so we'll think of something that we could do. Maybe when we're all at the Udvar-Hazy Center for Become a Pilot Day, we can talk about some scheme that would work to bring some of our listeners into the show. So speaking of the Udvar-Hazy, I'm afraid, Rob, should I click this button? Am I going to regret it, or should I just go ahead and let her rip?
I don't really know what you're talking about, Max.
Okay, well,
Here, I'm going to push this button.
We interrupt this broadcast for a special announcement. Please stand by.
Calling all airplane geeks. The Uvar Hazy Pavilion of the National Air and Space Museum, located at Washington Dulles Airport, has today announced that the airplane geeks have again been invited to perform their show on June the 15th in the Become a Pilot Day. Let me repeat. The Airplane Geeks will once again be doing their show live at the Air and Space Museum's Uvar Hazy Pavilion beginning at 11 a.m. on June 15th. Airplane geeks from all over the world are encouraged to attend and poke fun at those people you've been listening to for years. Watch how they pull the show out of thin air and create something that is incredibly interesting to airplane geeks everywhere. That's June 15th at the Air and Space Museum's Uvar Hazy Pavilion. Be there.
We now return you to the regularly scheduled Airplane Geek Show. Good luck with that.
All right. Well, that wasn't entirely painful.
David, isn't it the Uvar Hazy Center and not Pavilion?
It wasn't bad that you said it once. It was... Well, I guess it was the third or fourth time that you said pavilion that my skin started crawling.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, yeah, very good. Thanks for that, Rob. And we hope to see a lot of listeners for the event. I know there's already been some chatter on Twitter and other places about some of our listeners and fans showing up for that event. So we'll really look forward to meeting as many of you guys as possible.
And Max?
Yeah.
Two episodes ago, we were talking about Solar Impulse.
Yes.
Guess what's going to be it? Be a Pilot Day. Lord willing, and the weather don't holds up. But yeah, the gang at the Smithsonian are excited. I mean, and we put a buzz in Little Birdie's ear, and hopefully we'll get to talk to the crew of Solar Impulse, which would be really awesome.
That would be fantastic. And if you haven't heard that episode yet, that was episode 249, just two episodes ago, with Jason Parr from Wired. And he has met with and talked with the folks associated with the Solar Impulse plane. It's currently making its way across the United States just on solar power. And so that would be just a fantastic thing to see that and to be there for that. So there's another great reason to attend the event. Let's see if we can... touch on a few of the emails and voicemails that we've received from our listeners. Now, if we don't get to yours, please don't be mad at us. We have so much. It's just all great stuff. So we'll try to do as much as we can. Let's start off with Paul Filmer from skippiescage.com. Paul is like one of the most amazing aviation photographers I know. His work is just phenomenal. And you know what? It's not just aviation photography he does. He does other things as well. But the aviation stuff is fantastic. Skippiescage.com. We were talking about the Honda jet and the above wing engines on that jet. And he said, we were talking about what other aircraft had taken that approach. He said, of course, you mentioned the VFW 614. He said, but you forgot the aircraft that are still in service, all Russian. He says the Antonov AN-72 and 74 family and the Beriev BE-200 and BE-42. So, yeah, those are some interesting aircraft. They use this effect, the Kwanda effect. Which
Koleanda.
The Koleanda effect. It's unpronounceable because it's got too many weird letters in it. But anyway, this is the physics that... utilizes engine exhaust gas. When you sort of blow that over the wing, the upper surface of the wing, it actually creates lift. And that's the principle involved. Now, I don't know if the Honda jet is taking advantage of that or not, but at least these Antonovs are sort of based around that method. Next up, we have a voicemail from Jason on drones and aircraft carriers. Here's Jason.
Hey, geeks. This is Jason from Chicago. I just got done listening to episode 249 and the segment on the X-47 UCAP. Just a little point. The X-47 really wasn't the first drone, per se, to be operated from an aircraft carrier. 1943, the Navy tested the Naval Aircraft Factory TBN-1 torpedo drone from the USS Sable in Lake Michigan. Granted, it's not, there's a slight difference between an autonomous vehicle and a remotely piloted vehicle, but the TBN-1 actually did undertake a few catapult launches from Lake Michigan, but I'm sure the difference between a drone and a autonomous vehicle would be an interesting debate. But thanks for the good work, guys. Keep it up.
If Jason's really going to go down that route, in Korea, we used F-6F Hellcats off of aircraft carriers to take out bridges as flying bombs and drones.
Really?
They used F-7F Tiger Cats as drone controllers, where the back seat in the two-seat aircraft was used to pilot the F-6Fs, the war-weary F-6Fs from World War II, painted bright red, and each aircraft would be really unique because each tail was painted a different color: blue, green, pink, purple, red, yellow. And each one of those colors was the frequency for the drone controller to know what that aircraft was set up to fly as.
Huh.
But not that we're talking about that kind of stuff, and I shouldn't really prove my worth. But flying a drone is a jet drone is a little different than flying a propeller airplane next to a torpedo aircraft or a Hellcat.
All right. Well, we also got an email from Mike Smith. He's a private pilot, and he's taking tailwheel lessons right now, so that's great. And he's also, get this, finishing up, he's building a Sonics, and he's also a skydiver. He has 2,600 skydives. Can you imagine that, Rob? Jumped out 2,600 times. Mike says,
nope.
Yeah, I know, that's pretty good. That's a lot. He says he wants to make a prediction. He says, I believe the odds are in my favor. Here it is. There will never be autonomous or pilotless airliners with passengers on board. Never.
I'll take that bet.
So Mike gives us a lot of reasons. It may be kind of too much to go through right now, but these are all great issues, arguments as to why that may never come to be. But, you know, the one that he added to this list here that I hadn't thought of, as he says, can you imagine the flight attendants union on this one? Who is in charge when there is an unruly passenger or a medical emergency? Do you think the flight attendants want to take on those responsibilities? Does anyone think they should? How do you think they will feel about being responsible for handling in-flight airframe or engine emergencies? Does anyone really think that can be solved from the ground? What happens when there's a glitch in the comm data link to the ground during an emergency? So I think that's another interesting sort of issue that would have to be overcome is what's the role of the flight attendants?
Yeah, but can't we just, make the flight attendants disappear? I mean, I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but right now I know several airlines that the flight attendants don't even really do the seatbelt thing. They turn on the TV, maybe we could have a little robot that God forbid they need to open up the door and put out the ramps, but anything's possible. I'm just being very cynical and the devil's advocate. But yeah, we're going to have airplanes without pilots, folks. You just need to realize that.
I think it's going to be a long time before that comes. But everything can be worked out somehow.
I'm sorry, but in 2001, Pan Am flew to a space station without any pilot. At least that's what they told me in the early 70s when 2001 A Space Odyssey came out.
Kubrick movie, huh?
Well, I still keep hoping for my flying car, too.
The Jetsons. We heard from David. David says, just a friendly debate between my wife and I. He lives in Wisconsin, in a suburb of Milwaukee, and they have a 16-month-old son named Maxwell. Let's see. He says, and made a comment to my wife about how Oshkosh would be an awesome place to begin his geekdom. He says, hearing protection included, of course. His wife feels that 16 months, well, that he'd be 19 months by then, that may be a bit too early for his baptism into aviation. He says, I'm saying start early. What is your vote on this friendly debate? So what do you guys think? 16 months now, 19 months for Oshkosh. Do you think that's too young?
Nah, piece of cake. I mean, the legal limit, I read this in an FAR. It's buried deep in the text, though. Most people don't know about it. But it says that your child must be at least 12 months old before you can bring them to an air show. And so they're within the regs already, so I think it's no problem.
As I wrote David back personally, I said, I'm the wrong person to talk to, because when I was 9 months old, I went to my first air show. Now, mind you, I slept through, in the nipper nap chair, I slept through the Blue Angels Flying Phantoms. But at 9 months old, I was at my first air show. So I'm a firm believer that he's well past that, so go for it.
You just need to protect him from the sun, because it gets a little toasty out
there. The sun and the noise, exactly.
No, not even the noise. I'm sorry. But when I went to air shows, I didn't have to wear earphones. The whole point of the air show was the noise. None of this politically correct stuff like I have to ride a bike with a helmet.
You don't think it affected your hearing?
What?
Dave, is this why you shout so much, David?
You know, personally, having to wear earphones for 2 hours a night every Monday night for the last 4 years, that might have hurt my hearing.
Yeah, some of it especially. All right, on that note, I think we'll close the show. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest from Sporties, John Zimmerman. Find them at sporties.com, sporties.com. John's always a great guest. Always enjoy having him with us. We also want to thank our contributors. You were going to say something?
I actually was going to say for those people that perhaps found something offensive in the show tonight or in any other shows, they can just contact our customer service people at Plane Crazy Down Under, and if you can figure out what the Sam Hill they're saying, I'm sure they'll take your complaint.
All right. Well, you can find them at planecrazydownunder.com. Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer, as always, we enjoy the Australia Desk reports. Look forward to them each week. Also, Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. Always a great one. And you can find his podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell folks where they can find each of us. And Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, it won't be in Australia because they do really mean things to the kangaroos down there. So I could not even visit a place like that. But be that as it may, in the meantime, we'll be up here in the States at jetwine.com and Jetwine on Twitter and other various and sundry places around Facebook. And who knows, maybe Google Plus someday if I ever figure out how to run that thing.
Okay. And David Vanderhoof, I know you're online and actively so. Tell us where we can find you.
Well, you can find me this week sobbing uncontrollably because my doctor has left. Being a Doctor Who fan, to find out that my second favorite doctor of all time is leaving the show in December was depressing. And I know our people, all of our friends in the UK will grasp and understand the trauma that this is causing.
But we must mention, David, that today was Bad Wolf Day.
Yes, it was. But otherwise, you can find me online at DM Vanderhoof, on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. On Google Plus, I know how to operate that, Rob, at David Vanderhoof. And, of course, I'm always poking around our beloved Airplane Geeks Facebook page where everybody participates. And I love it when we get lots and lots of hits. So keep up the good work, folks.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter and Google Plus as Max Flight. Also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find links to the sites that we mentioned, the news stories, the stuff that we talk about, all in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 251. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. And now you can also get us on TuneIn. That's TuneIn.com. It's a streaming service. It's kind of similar to Stitcher, but a little bit different. Stitcher, if you've got bandwidth considerations, Stitcher might be a better choice because they actually take our recording and compress it to a smaller format, so you lose a little bit of audio quality, but less bandwidth consumed. At TuneIn, you get the full boat quality. And so if you'd like to stream us there, check that out. TuneIn is showing up in more and more cars.
That's the whole enchilada.
It's the whole enchilada, every bit of it, even the hot sauce. Be sure to find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. And if you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Of course, we also have a listener line. You can leave us a voicemail there. Aunt Benet has that number for you.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the 5th year anniversary of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, folks. Good night.
I read this afternoon and my head exploded.
What came out, David? Oh, never mind.
Not a whole hell of a lot.
C-17s on and C-5. Hang on.
Standby for fact checking.
Just scratching head and remembering. Yeah, but the
aircraft is quite interesting, actually, to find that model, which, as you say, is quite rare and very, very old.
Indeed, mate. Indeed. Well,
a bit like Rob Mark.
Oh, you beat me to it. I was going to drop that line.
sorry, mate. Well, go for it. I'll cut it out.
As you wish.
Sure, Peter. I think I touched the line.
It's okay.
I touched the cable with my hand. Just I moved my hand. Listen, I will try to hide no the cable also.
It's not. Yeah, that's it. Hey, listen, you're going to feature in the outtakes.
No, I'm not going to touch it again.
Okay.
I don't want to touch it again.
The aviation stuff is fantastic. Skippy'sCage.com.
Yeah, I heard he's actually going to start doing radio celebrities and speedos. He's sending those to Mary Kirby for review.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure she'll get a kick out of that.